Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Call. Rose Aguilar is away on vacation. The extremist hate group, the Proud Boys, were key to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021. They have been sentenced for their roles in the attack. Enrique Tarrio, the group's former leader, was handed a sentence of 22 years for seditious conspiracy. That is the longest sentence given so far to those involved. The Department of Justice investigation into January 6 has seen more than 1,100 people arrested and charged. Several Republicans and presidential nominees have complained the sentences are too harsh. Two of the candidates, Vivek Ramaswamy and Ron DeSantis, have floated the idea of pardons for defendants under a Republican administration. On today's Your Call, we'll look back on January 6th and forward to the integrity of future elections. We'll talk, too, about how extremist groups like the Proud Boys have expanded their reach. They've made inroads with the Republican Party, and whether those long sentences passed down could be a deterrent for future extremist and white supremacist violence. Joining me today is A.C. Thompson. He's a staff reporter with ProPublica. His stories examine the criminal justice system. He's a print and web journalist, and he's reported extensively for television, serving as a producer and correspondent for PBS Frontline. He was fictionalized, too, in the HBO show Tremé. A.C., welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to lay out some basics here. We keep talking about the Proud Boys, and we've talked a little bit more about other organizations. The Proud Boys have the prominence. Why is that? How prominent a role did they play that day?
If you think about it, there were really kind of two key groups that were the tip of the violent spear on January 6th. One was the militia group, the Oath Keepers, led by Stuart Rhodes. The other was the Proud Boys. And so I think what we saw on that day and what federal prosecutors have really focused on is the sort of key role that they played in organizing the militancy that day, penetrating the Capitol building, and basically carrying out the attack. In a lot of ways, there were many, many, many people involved that day, obviously, but they were sort of catalytic actors.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about whether they're true believers or whether they're opportunists. You've talked to so many people, and I've seen your PBS documentaries, which I very much encourage people to take a look at on Frontline. We've seen a lot of opportunism, politically and otherwise, over the last, let's say, 6-8 years. And one of the things that's always hard to tell is, does this person or does this group really believe what they're mouthing? Or are they taking advantage of something cataclysmic to advance their own agendas? What's your sense with the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers about that?
I think there's some of A and some of B with a lot of these groups. You know, if you look at the neo-Nazi groups that I started talking to back in the time of Charlottesville, they would all say, look, we like President Trump, then President Trump, but he's not radical enough for us. But we like some of the things he says. And I think you've seen the same thing with Stuart Rhodes, who's gone back and forth about whether he supports Trump today. And you've seen the same thing with the Proud Boys. If you're in the Proud Boys chats today, in their Telegram messages, there are people who very much feel like the Donald Trump and the Republicans have abandoned them and were never their true allies anyway. And there are people who are absolutely still true believers and still supporters of Trumpism.
Is that different than immediately previous to January 6th in that when we saw the protests beginning to happen, there did seem to be a unanimity around Donald Trump? And with them to some extent falling away now, I'm wondering if that has an impact on the potential for more demonstrations and more trouble in the coming election.
Yeah. So I would say, having been at those demonstrations leading up to January 6th, when I saw the Proud Boys in the streets over and over and over again engaged in violence, my impression was this is a group that absolutely believes in this mission of fighting what they see to be a fraudulent, bogus election and, you know, the ouster of who they saw to be the rightfully elected president, Donald Trump. I think that was a true, sincerely held belief by most of them at that time, and also an excuse to engage in violence and street fighting. I think the key thing that worries me now going forward is when I talk to sociologists of the far right, they say, look, the fault lines in America that have not been resolved since January 2021. There are huge numbers of Americans, nearly half the country, if you believe surveys, that would vote for Donald Trump again. That is a sort of tacit endorsement to his belief that he was wrongly denied the presidency last time. There is the conspiracy theories and extremist rhetoric and fact-free thinking that permeate the far right are now mainstream items in American politics. These are mainstream features of American politics. And that does not bode well for the next presidential election. I think when people look at the 2020 midterms, they'll say this. They'll say this to me. They say, oh, you know, it was a repudiation of Trumpism and extremism. Most of the Trump candidates didn't win. I think that's the wrong message to take. What you really see is most of those candidates lost by a quite slim margin of swing voters. And there were millions of people in each state who supported very outrageous, extremist, conspiracy theory, election denialist candidates. That does not bode well for the future.
Let's talk for a minute about your very presence there. You know, we're learning a lot from you because, as opposed to observing it from afar, you were in the midst of it. Was there evidently a split between the people who had already organized and given some forethought to what was about to happen at the Capitol and those who may have been surprised, those who were there for a speech and were there for a calm protest and going home? Did you see that kind of eruption of what the heck is going on here?
So to clarify, my colleague Ford was on the ground on January 6th for my team that day. I arrived January 7th like a fool.
Right.
right. But I had been at a lot of militia rallies and Stop the Steal rallies prior to January 6th. And I think they're 100% like what you would see is people who are showing up to rally and pray and march around, and also people who are showing up to fight and try to stop the certification of the election. I think both of those things were there. And this is a typical sort of scenario. If you have tens of thousands of people and you have a militant faction there that's going to take advantage of that broader crowd and push a more radical agenda, a more militant agenda, that's not a surprising thing. That's a very typical thing to think. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, all of those rallies, all the rhetoric around it was very, very charged. It was very, very, this is the end of democracy. We have to do something dramatic. And so it didn't take that much to push people into a very dramatic posture. The social media chatter, the discussion up ahead of January 6th, articulated and orchestrated by then President Trump, was very much like, take action today or you will not have a country tomorrow. So, you know, while there was a mix of the people that I would see who would be like showing up to Stop the Steal rally and they just want to, you know, hold their sign, and people who wanted to show up and fight or, you know, take dramatic violent action, I think it didn't take very much to push those less aggressive people into dramatic violent action.
You know, we're going to intermittently talk about the role of the media here. And I'm glad you caught me in that error about your having been at the protest, because I was conflating that with your presence at Charlottesville. And I'm wondering, with what you saw there, the protest in Charlottesville and the trajectory to January 6th, did you see appropriate, thorough and basic media coverage that let people know this was all possible? What was the role of the media between one and the next?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the media, when it came to both events, was somewhat caught off guard and was not prepared. And I would count myself in that to some extent. You know, I think if you were reading the chats before Charlottesville, you would see people are talking about bringing bats and guns and bear spray and knives and helmets, and you would expect this is likely to become very violent. But that was not necessarily something that was out there in the mainstream media, that people really understood what the stakes were that day. And it was clearly not something that the police in Charlottesville understood. In the same way, I think there was a failure to recognize the depth of the discord around the 2020 presidential election throughout the country. I don't think that a lot of reporters understood that, hey, this message that the election was stolen, that's not a fringe message. That's a message that is resonating with millions of Americans. And when you have somebody like Donald Trump putting out an angry, conspiratorial, bogus, demagogic message to millions of Americans, many of whom believe it, you should expect horrible things to happen. I don't think the media was prepared, honestly, but more important, in both cases, you had major policing and intelligence failures. And that the bigger story, I would say, in both cases.
That's A.C. Thompson, staff reporter with ProPublica. He's also reported extensively for television, producer and correspondent for PBS's Frontline. Joining us now, Andy Campbell. He's senior editor and reporter at HuffPost, where he focuses on crime and extremism. He is also the author of We Are Proud Boys, How a Right-Wing Street Gang Ushered in a New Era of American Extremism. Andy, with what A.C. Thompson was just saying, it reminds me of something that I saw a day or two ago in the news, where nearly one in three Americans believes now that Americans are dropping dead from the COVID-19 jab. And that, of course, is coming from an extreme right. And I'm wondering about, with your focus on Proud Boys, how you've seen that kind of message percolating, where it starts from an extreme, and the next thing you know, a ton of people are believing it. And again, I'm going to put the question to you that I put to AC, and that is, what kind of media coverage did you see around this, and what do you think they learned from that?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought this up, because, you know, these conspiracy theories, at least in the Trump era, often come from the same places, and it's hard to make them go away, if they go away at all. I mean, the same voices who are pushing anti-vax conspiracy theories today are the same people who helped gin up support for what was happening on January 6th. And they're the same people who made a bunch of people believe that there was a pedophile ring under a pizza restaurant in D.C. run by Hillary Clinton, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The extremist conspiratorial far right moment, it involves a lot of the same talking heads, and that's not really going away. If you're asking about media responsibility here, I write it a lot in my book about how you know, the media, especially sort of the mainstream national media, has played a role in.
Oh, we're losing Andy there. I think we might need to get him on a better line. Let's try to get him back. Andy Campbell is senior editor and Republican reporter at HuffPost. I don't know how that happened. We're going to continue, though, with A.C. Thompson of ProPublica and PBS Frontline. A.C., you talked about the trail of the riot from Trump's instigation just a few moments ago. And I'm wondering, if that were to occur again, if we saw him, specifically Donald Trump, doing that kind of instigation, has he lost enough power to where it may not evolve the same way? What's the stance where he's involved? We said earlier that people are falling away from him. Does he retain enough power to do this again?
Yeah, I don't think anybody is totally clear on that. I would be concerned about his polling numbers. They are remarkable.
Yeah.
They are absolutely stunning for somebody who helped to instigate that attack on our nation's democracy and has now been criminally indicted four times. The fact that he has that kind of staying power in a field of, frankly, less criminal, less problematic characters, whatever you think about them. So I would be very concerned about that. But in some ways, that's maybe not the point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we may never see a mass violent attack of that nature again, involving thousands and thousands of people. What is much more likely that we'll see are acts of stochastic, terrorism carried out by smaller groups or individuals who believe that they are acting to save the Republic. Their leader, Donald Trump, has said the election's been stolen, democracy is over. And by the way, there are all these other evils that you should be fighting. And so I would expect that we will see those people take violent, direct action in a terroristic fashion. And we've already seen that. The number of threats to public officials, the number of bomb threats, the numbers of actual planted bombs and physical attacks on public officials that we've seen. This is already happening. But I think that's much more likely to be what we see are sort of narrower acts of very violent, dramatic action.
Mm-hmm. Andy Campbell is back. Let me put the same question to him. The relative power of Donald Trump now, Andy, compared to where we were after the election in 2020, do you think he does carry that same kind of power?
You know, our extremist factions right now are mobilizing on the word of whoever the loudest mouthpiece is on the far right. You know, for a while it was Donald Trump, and that may well be again going into this next election as he likely becomes the next Republican candidate for president. But to bounce off what AC said, or rather add to it, you know, the Proud Boys haven't gone away since January 6th. The Proud Boys are still mobilizing at drag queen story hours in public libraries, attacking and harassing people wherever the GOP's culture war is. Mm-hmm. And instead of Donald Trump's word or Tucker Carlson's word sort of mobilizing these forces, it's now Ron DeSantis and Moms for Liberty and whoever the loudest talking head is at the time. So I agree with AC that this extremist moment doesn't go away if Donald Trump goes away, and it doesn't go away if even the Proud Boys or any number of groups dissolve tomorrow. This is political violence is ingrained in the GOP such that violence is a justified option in politics right now. And that's the issue underlying all of it.
That sounds really valuable. In fact, AC, for one of your pieces that you did for Frontline, American Insurrection, you talked to a longtime source named Pete Seamy, and he said something along the same lines. He was talking about, rather than focus on this hate group or that hate group, that it's more productive to look at their larger worldview. And that sounds very much like what Andy was just saying.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, I recently talked to Pete, and he said, you know, all these sort of factors that we see that contributed to this moment have not abated. And we talked about things like white folks, particularly white working class people, feeling that they have diminished status, diminished economic opportunities, that they're being pushed out. We talked about the way that the internet has fragmented our news ecosystem, and that everyone now is a researcher and they can find the viewpoint that speaks to them and realize where the COVID-19 epidemic really happened, really started, or what the true story behind the 2020 election is, or what the true story behind Pizzagate is, whatever it is. And that there are a lot of these factors. Another one would be structural inequality. You know, we are living in a age of a new gilded digital age of epic inequality. And that is not surprising that that's going to cause some very dramatic responses.
Mm-hmm. These are not, I'm going to stay with you, AC, for this one. Oh, let me first invite our listeners to call in, because I'm sure you have some questions and comments on this topic of conversation. AC Thompson on the line. So is Andy Campbell. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255 to get here on your call. And I'm Angie Coiro, sitting in for Rose today. Andy, I do want to stay with you and ask you about something else that is very important to hit on. And that is that these aren't all clusters of little groups meeting here and there at coffee shops, whatever. This is coming too from the American military. Talk about that entanglement.
Right, certainly. I mean, you know, many of our biggest extremist groups, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers militia, even, you know, certain neo-Nazi factions have built their recruitment around the police, around law enforcement, and around military, they're very attractive to, or try to be very attractive to military personnel. You know, when you're out, you can continue your work as a military operative by utilizing your training to fight against nefarious, shadowy forces on the left, or against whatever grievance these groups are ginning up at the time. And so, you know, we've found that not only are there military and law enforcement personnel in the Proud Boys, but that because, you know, perhaps that we don't have a federal domestic terrorist statute, it's not, you know, illegal or necessarily against military protocol to be a member of these groups. And so we found deferring responses when a police department or a military outfit finds out one of their own is a member of the Proud Boys. It's not necessarily, you know, a barring factor for you. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get kicked out of their police force. Because some police forces will say, hey, well, you're a seditious group. Clearly, after January 6th, you're out. Another police force might say it's not illegal. We have freedom of speech in this country. And so it's, you know, it's not a matter of public opinion to root out these, you know, connections between the military, law enforcement, and our extremist groups. And it's been something that's concerning as we follow these, you know, if I out a law enforcement officer in the Proud Boys and HuffPost, that doesn't necessarily mean that that threat is going away.
Right.
But certainly that person is still a threat to, you know, the communities. It's certainly a bias issue.
Mm-hmm. AC, you went pretty deeply into this in American Insurrection. Can you add on to this?
Yeah. I was just at this neo-Nazi rally in Orlando, Florida, recently, and the leader of one of those groups, a group called the Blood Tribe, is a guy named Christopher Polhouse. And, you know, he's one of these guys who served in the Marines. The Marine Corps confirmed to me that he served from 2005 to 2009. He was assigned to the 1st Tank Battalion. He was a corporal, so he was a lower-ranking service member. But it speaks to this ongoing problem that we have with radicalization within the ranks. And I would say the current administration has been much, much, much more diligent and aggressive about identifying extremism within the military ranks, training on it, doing something. It is not, they have not done enough. And I think they would stipulate that they have not done enough. But this is a persistent problem. If you look at domestic extremist attacks going back the last 30 years, a significant proportion of them are carried out by current or former military service members. And so that's a big ongoing problem. And like I said, I think the current administration is doing more, but it could do better to, you know, much better to continue to root out these individuals.
You're listening to Your Call. We're going to come back after a break here. We've got George on the line from San Rafael. He's first in the lineup. If you would like to join, we have an open phone line at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, as we continue to talk about the January 6th insurrection and what impact it may have on future coverage by the media and, of course, on the coming election. I'm Angie Corr, and for Rose, this is Your Call. Welcome back to Your Call, and we're going to go to the phone lines at 866-798-8255. George has a really fascinating question to ask of our guests, A.C. Thompson and Andy Campbell. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I just want to point out that this is the same situation that happens over and over again for, what are we going to say, 2,000 years, 2,400 years? I'm in power. I don't want you to come after me for what I am doing to put you in the position of being weaker, poor, starving. So I'll point to the other person. And the reason I can point to the other person is for two reasons. One, they're different than you. That's simple. People can grasp that. And two, if you do what I tell you to do, you'll fix the problem in 5 minutes. tomorrow everything will be beautiful. And that's really what we're facing here, and no one is really dealing with that issue directly and head on.
I mean, you
we
were
have
talking...
this great massive method of being able to communicate with people. What happens if someone from the far right actually was publicly debating or publicly stating their issues with someone from the more moderate wing and a more left wing? Where does that exist? It doesn't.
And so you were talking about the role of right-wing radio, George. You were talking about the role of right-wing radio in this, and there's a lot to be said there.
Right. Well, that's a perfect example, right-wing radio. What would happen if publicly some of those people were actually challenged to sit down with someone who didn't agree with their views and could point out all the issues so that the public actually had access to it and could listen to it? Are you going to convince everyone? No. But 80%? Probably.
Let's take that over to Andy Campbell. Andy with HuffPost, it's really a departure to find out whether the audience would follow a group that normally is bashing from the left to the right or vice versa and say, interview someone moderate. I think amongst everything else, what they're doing is they're jeopardizing their commercial sales because that's not what they're there to talk about.
Right. Well, if you take a look at far right media, especially in the Trump era, I mean, it is designed for entertainment purposes and for obfuscation of blame for far right actors. And so there have been times when, say, Fox News or Steve Bannon on his radio show have brought on, someone from the far left to sort of crush them and stomp their voice down, right? But there has never been a concerted effort, as you said, to bring on, voices from the other side to sort of bring depth to conversations on the right. I mean, these far right media operations are propaganda at their best at this point.
AC, I take it that PBS is one of our few sources that does try to do something without an agenda.
I always say to people when I'm at these events, I say, look, we reported critically on President Obama. We reported critically on President Trump. We're reporting critically on President Biden. And then usually people will say, except President Biden's not truly the president. Donald Trump is the rightful president. But yeah, I mean, I think like what we try to have is a point of view that we are going to go out, collect facts and let those facts take us where they may. And when you're doing an investigative report, you're going to develop a point of view from the evidence that you collect carefully, thoughtfully and fairly. And in some of my work, that point of view has been, hey, there's an extremism problem in the military. Here's what the data and the statistics and the incidents show. But that's also something that comes from that true fact-finding process.
Mm-hmm. I want to make a quick note. We're going to go to Stephen in San Francisco in just a moment. Hold that thought, Stephen, because I do want to take note of something that just came out of my mouth, and I hate when I do it, and that is to play the both sides game, the propaganda from the left and the right. Andy, I'm curious what you think when you hear that kind of equivalency.
Right. Well, a lot of people, when I speak about the Proud Boys, when I speak about the far-right violence leading up to January 6th and beyond, they like to say, well, what about Antifa? What about BLM? And like AC said, as a reporter, I'm going to show you the facts that we deal with. If Antifa, if BLM were committing acts of violence on the same scale as the far right, we would absolutely be reporting it. And we do report it when it does happen, right? Mm-hmm. But take the 2020 BLM demonstrations, for example. Extremist experts, the government, and Harvard professors came together to bring data on those demonstrations. And out of thousands of demonstrations that summer across the country, 99.8% of them were not only peaceful, but didn't even get a call to police for destruction of property or violence, right? Mm-hmm. The majority, vast majority of these things were violent. But if you watch Fox News, you believe that some of those cities are still on fire today because of the B-roll of a police car or a building on fire that they show over and over and over again. And mm-hmm. so, there is to both sides means to elevate something that doesn't exist to the same level as something that does exist, which is that the government, even Trump's own government officials, found that far right violence vastly outweighs any time in American history and vastly outweighs that on the left right now. And that's just the facts right now.
And some more facts before we go to Stephen. There was an AP investigation in 2021, and they found that where BLM protests did turn violent, more than 120 defendants either pled guilty or been convicted and sentenced to prison terms of a little over 2 years on average. But in the 1,100 cases related to January 6th, according to an NPR database, the median prison sentence was just 120 days. An interesting bit of fact there. Stephen, I thank you for your kind patience. You are on the air here on Your Call.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, can hear you just fine.
Yeah, I just had to turn the radio down. I have a number of concerns, and the first of which is when we talk about extremism in this country, prison has been told repeatedly since 9/11, yesterday being the 22nd anniversary. I worked downtown in Manhattan when that happened, so it was a bit activating for me, so excuse me if I'm a little impassioned about this, but the fact of the matter is prison emboldens and radicalizes people. And these far-right groups, a lot of them, the journalist can verify this, but a lot of them are generated white supremacists, come out of prison as white supremacists who did not go in as white supremacists because of the way that the gang structure in prison works. My father has worked in prison reform and religious ministry for the Salvation Army, so I know a little bit about what I'm talking. Finally, the point I'm trying to make here is that when Adolf Hitler was lightly sentenced in Weimar Germany, we see exactly what that led to, and the pattern continues, and the pattern continues. The light sentencing, these are light sentences these people are facing. When you have treason or sedition against this country, the best you can offer is life in prison, because capital offenses, these are capital punishments. Right now, every single day in Ukraine is 9/11 and Lahaina combined, every single day. Now, the reason Trump was impeached the first time was because he enabled Putin to do what he's doing. Putin wants to be Stalin, and we are at world war right now, not just a quiet civil war, not just a quiet cold war in this country, but we are at a world war, and we are letting
Stephen,
Ukraine
I want to bring this back on point. So let me take to AC what you were talking about with people essentially becoming energized by the right wing when they're in custody. AC, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'd love to hear Andy chime in too. It's been fascinating to me to see that some of these January 6ers are now like prison reformers, and they compare themselves to Guantanamo inmates. Enrique Tarrio just said, reform prisons in one of his recent tweets after being, or Telegram posts after being sentenced to prison to the 22 years. So I do think there's fascinating thing, which is that some of these people are actually realizing like, oh, the prison industrial complex is not a good thing. But I do think, to the caller's point, we should be concerned about a deepening of radicalization with some of these characters.
Mm-hmm. Andy, let me bring you in on this, because, of course, you wrote a book on the Proud Boys. What do you see being the active factors in taking someone who may not have these inclinations and making them embrace this kind of philosophy?
Yeah, just speaking back to prison for a minute, it is true that a lot of these guys are coming under the realization that American prison system is tough, but to the caller's point, we are finding out through all of these prosecutions that you cannot prosecute your way out of an extremist crisis. I mean, none of these guys are sort of standing down from their original viewpoints following their sentences, and meanwhile, the sentences themselves have not been a deterrent to ongoing extremist violence based on, far right talking points. And so what we are finding out now is that, prosecutions, the consequences of the criminal justice system are only one factor at play when you're trying to bring down an ideological extremist crisis.
I want to pull that apart a little bit, because at that point you're saying that even if we were to take these people and put them in life sentences, it wouldn't make any difference?
I would say that it's only one factor, because you still have the Proud Boys are still embraced by the GOP. Mm-hmm. There are Proud Boys who are running for and successfully getting local seats in office. There are, you know, GOP members who still celebrate the Proud Boys and use them as bodyguards at their events. And so to root out the extremist crisis, you have to have, you know, the criminal justice aspect is one factor, but then you also have to root them out of the law enforcement and military. You have to have the GOP rebuke for once, which it never has, rebuke its neo-fascist foot soldiers in the streets. That, you know, they've never done that because they see them as champions for Trump in the street. And then you also you also have to have a government that is willing to accept the results of elections. So you have to root out the conspiracy theories. It is a huge process of rooting this problem out. And it's going to take several election cycles if we start now.
Mm-hmm. Andy just made the point, AC, that this is ongoing despite the fact that these sentences are being handed down. And you were covering another extremist event. That was you were in Orlando covering two neo-Nazi groups who staged rallies just after a Jacksonville shooting that killed three black shoppers at a store. And then these groups are Blood Tribe and the Goyim Defense League, which would be funny in any other context. They were gathered outside of Disney World September 2nd, and they were carrying flags with Nazi insignia, anti-LGBTQ flags, and symbols of white supremacy. So tell us what you learned while you were covering that.
Yeah. I think Andy's point that you can't incarcerate your way out of this is a good point. You know, so being in Florida, it was fascinating and obviously disturbing to me to see that, you know, I think the overt neo-Nazi groups and the overt, very obvious white nationalist groups had kind of died off to some extent after Charlottesville. There was a major backlash after Charlottesville, and a lot of those groups went underground or disbanded or took on slightly less offensive optics and visuals. I think that's coming back now in a big way. And I think that's what we're seeing in Florida with these repeated neo-Nazi rallies by a lot of different groups over the last 18 months. I'll tell you a fascinating thing to me that speaks to this interplay between extremism and the mainstream is people at both of the rallies that day in the Orlando area were pro DeSantis. They were not Trumpists. They were pro Ron DeSantis, the governor and presidential candidate. And so I think that tells you a little bit about the way extremist messaging has infected the mainstream mm-hmm. and the way it bounces back to the extremists.
I want to stay with you, AC, because you were talking to someone on one of your frontline documentaries, and this is a militant person who says the time for peace is past. And that indicates that while there probably will be more protests and there probably will be more shootings, it looks as though organized, intense violence could be just around the corner. How common is he and his point of view?
You know, I think one thing I want to surface here is like, look, this country had 20 years of constant war. We have, spawned generations of people who spent time on the battlefield, were profoundly traumatized by it, were deeply damaged by it, and have come back to this country. And oftentimes, every problem they see looks like a problem that can be fixed through violence, through sort of quasi-military or guerrilla action. And so I think that viewpoint is quite widespread. And I think that that's a deep concern. And to be sure, like my father served in the U.S. Army, my father-in-law served in the U.S. Navy. Most military people are not, you know, cut from the extremist cloth. Certainly those gentlemen are not. But there is a, you know, something that's changed in our culture, I believe, having these wars go on for decades and cycling through so many men and exposing them to hyper-violence and hyper-trauma.
Andy, let's go back to something you were saying about the Proud Boys and their ilk showing up now at drag queen hours and at other civil gatherings where they're making their presence known. Do you think that the opposition to that point of view is organized enough? Are they aware enough that this is happening? Are we starting to see some organization on the side against Proud Boys, et cetera?
Right. Well, you know, unfortunately, the only thing that's worked against the street level gangs that we have running around so far have been communities organizing against them. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that all of the prosecutions after the neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville came together because the local community pulled together, protested them, and then outed each and every one of their names for prosecutors to use. And that led to a $25 million successful lawsuit against the architects of Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. Same goes for January 6th. The majority of the thousands of arrests that were made came together because regular sleuths pulled all of their resources together and outed thousands of people and sort of, you know, figured out a way to come together as a community and push back against the extremist threat. And it's always been up to communities. But you know, if we're going back to the neo-Nazis real quick, organizing, I want to make clear to your listeners that I think the threat here isn't, oh my gosh, the Nazis are going to come mm-hmm. to your door tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. The threat here is that before each and every one of these events, before Charlottesville, before January 6th, there were extremist forces putting their toes in the water, seeing if they were embraced, seeing if the public lashed out against them. And so before Charlottesville, there were dozens of rallies, smaller rallies, right? Before January 6th, dozens and dozens of violent Donald Trump rallies. And this is the neo-Nazis putting their toes in the water, jumping out and saying, hey, we're here. Are we embraced? Do we feel comfortable right now? And in Florida, the resounding answer right now is yes. And so that's the concern that we're looking at going forward. Can the communities come together and push back alongside law enforcement? And so far in Florida, we're seeing that the answer is no.
Well, AC, what about Charlottesville? Because I'm sure that residents there were horribly surprised at what went down with the protests there. Would they be surprised again, or are they organized in being ready for it to happen?
No, I don't think that they would be surprised. And the residents there knew something bad was coming, for sure. I don't know that they were prepared to something of that scale. And they, you know, there was not an ability to mobilize enough people to really effectively confront that event, I would say. And obviously there was terrible policing. I don't think people there would be surprised now, but I think Andy's point that there are places in this country where you can hold a Nazi rally or a white nationalist rally or a big Proud Boy event, and you won't really get that much pushback, and you will feel a certain level of comfort. That should be very concerning to Americans. And that's Florida, but it's also other states as well.
I want to take what we've learned from all of these events and throw the spotlight over to the makeup of these groups and what, moving forward, that information can help us to shape our response. Ms. Magazine pointed out that as well as being against non-white people and being against people who don't look like them, a lot of these groups are focused on white masculinity, that as they called it, cartoonishly hyper-masculine groups. Let's talk about the role and the image of women first, and then we're going to talk as well about race. Let me start with this, with you, AC. In the documentaries with Frontline, we do see women taking roles at the microphone, you know, at some of the protests, but they are vastly outnumbered by the men.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like the absence is pretty obvious. These are groups that work in an incredibly patriarchal mindset, that oftentimes they want their women supporters, wives, friends, girlfriends to be away from the front lines and not involved in the direct action. They are casting back to an imaginary past where there were these traditional gender roles. Mm-hmm. And that is a big piece of this, you know, is that sort of patriarchal worldview.
Andy, can you talk about that as well? The groups and their attitudes towards women and the involvement of women. Where do the women get involved in that small role they have?
Right. You know, one of the Proud Boys' inside rules is venerate the housewife. They do want to go back to these, non-existent sort of fantastical norms that they've set for themselves. And the other, edict that they have is we only allow men in our group. And our ultimate goal is to commit political violence for GOP causes. And so it as a rule doesn't involve women, but in my research and in talking to people, one interesting thing I found was that a lot of the pushback, a lot of the sort of anonymous anti-fascists working online and in the street against these guys are women. It was very surprising to me to see how many women were, they got no kudos for doing this. They often put their bodies on the line, put themselves in danger, but were the community leaders fighting back, organizing churches and businesses and local leaders together whenever they learned that the Proud Boys were coming into town. And so women's role is in opposition to the Proud Boys, and that's been really cool to see.
It is. It is. I'm glad I asked that because it's good to hear that. Now, of course, the question was about going forward as well. Do you see women continuing to work in these roles? Are they getting encouraged? Because as you say, they weren't really given the kudos that they deserved. Now that might cause some falling away.
Certainly on the community organization and the anti-fascist work, I think women will continue. And none of the people I spoke to have stopped doing what they're doing. But you are seeing women crop up their own groups on the far right side. I mean, if you look at Moms for Liberty, which is this national organization that's doing grassroots work for far right candidates, and especially, with DeSantis and his type of politician, they are sidling up next to the Proud Boys. They are calling on far-right extremists to be essentially bodyguards at events. And Moms for Liberty, which consists mostly of women, has shown up at school board meetings where they're talking about, LGBTQ literature alongside members of the Proud Boys. And so on the far right, there are women organizing and having a role in the street, but it's often not the sort of direct violence. It's more political legitimization of these groups that women are doing.
This is fascinating. I want to stay with this, looking at the makeup of the groups, because this is what we'll have to contend with as we go forward. And for that, AC, let's talk about the youngest people in the groups, about youth coming up on the right with hateful attitudes and exposure to some very hateful ideas. What have you learned? What have you heard from the youth in these movements?
You know, the thing that I see that really concerns me is that you have a lot of sort of colonization of different video game platforms and video game adjacent platforms by these groups, and a sort of outreach to normie, average young people playing video games and in other sort of cultural spaces by these groups. So like the Goyim Defense League, one of the groups in Florida at the Nazi rally, they had a Roblox channel. Roblox is a video game that primarily targets younger kids. Mm. And they would be there proselytizing and terrorizing and trying to recruit people there. We've seen the same thing with the video game platform Steam. We've seen the same thing with Discord, which is the text and voice service that many people use while they're playing video games or to facilitate their gaming. So I think in ye old days, you would hear about like hate rock and like white power music. Nowadays, I think what you're seeing is the use of all these tools often are in the video game space to find new recruits from the youth.
Andy, have you seen any successful attempts to pull youth out of the groups?
I think that it again goes back to that sort of community organization aspect. Law enforcement so far has been unable to, or seemingly unable to, keep up with the extremist groups moving from platform to platform as they get outed. One example is, the Proud Boys used to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars on platforms like GiveSendGo and GoFundMe until people online found them out, rooted them out, and then told these platforms that they were using them, after which these platforms would work to push them out. But none of this work is coming from, say, the federal government, right? And so it's not just that they're targeting younger crowds. It's that they are very good at moving from platform to platform, and the only people keeping up are people who are paying attention, without any sort of kudos, or without — these aren't people who are doing it as a job, right? These mm-hmm. are people who are doing it out of concern. So AC is right. It is a concern how many platforms and where these groups are trying to recruit people. And it really takes a whole lot of community effort to keep an eye on these guys, both online and off.
I really appreciate the time you two have taken with me. A.C. Thompson is a staff reporter with ProPublica. You may have seen his work for PBS series Frontline. We'll link some of that from our website. And if you watched Treme and you saw the reporter, that was him. Andy, not the actor, the fictionalized character. Andy Campbell is senior editor and reporter at HuffPost. You can look up his book, We Are Proud Boys, How a Right-Wing Street Gang Ushered in a New Era of American Extremism. Many thanks to B. Soul for putting together the show today and doing all of that research. David LaTulipe has been on the board. You are listening to KALW, and thank you for that. I'll be back with you soon. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Call.